world is dying, the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words paraphrased from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is very gratefully sponsored by the Nation magazine and available on all podcasting platforms. Today, I want to take up the issue of Donald Trump's foreign policy, which is, I think, taken a lot of people by surprise. In the his first term, 2017 to 2021, Trump used a lot of America First rhetoric, but actually had a fairly conventional Republican foreign policy. Some differences on the margin, but really in continuity with a lot of stuff previous administrations, including Democratic administrations, had done. This time, we're actually seeing Trump do America first. He has people on his staff and his nominees who share his ideology much more so in the first term. And it's really upset the apple cart. One sees it, especially in Europe, with the sort of moves in Ukraine, which are very upsetting towards a lot of European partners. And I want to underscore that in a lot of ways, this America First foreign policy has a lot of contradictions, or at least seeming contradictions. And that, especially for people perhaps on the left end of the political spectrum, there's some real dilemma here, because some of the stuff that the Trump administration is saying should actually be welcomed. We've had Secretary of State Marco Rubio say that the unipolar moment is over and that we're in a multipolar era. And we've had Donald Trump say he wants to work with President Xi and Putin to cut nuclear weapons by 50%. He wants to cut Pentagon spending by 8% a year for 5 years, which would be a 40% cut. And he wants the United States to avoid, future wars. Conversely, a lot of this policy has also been straight out great power imperialism of a 19th century sort. The return of Manifest Destiny, of wanting to take over Canada, Greenland, Panama. So what are we to make of all this? I can't think of anyone who's actually better situated to do so than my guest, Stephen Wertheim of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who's actually written about a lot of these contradictions and has tried to unpack it. And I think shares my sense of realizing we can't just denounce Trump. We have to actually try to understand what's actually happening here and what is rhetoric and what is real. So first of all, welcome to the show, Stephen.
Really, really appreciate the chance to speak with you again.
And let's just get started with, what do we think is actually going on? Because I think you've written very well that, this is not Trump first term. This is something very different. So what's your big picture sense of what is actually happening?
So I think in general, when we try to interpret Trump as a figure or the Trump administration on foreign policy, there are two opposite tendencies that lead people astray. One is wish casting or sane washing, saying that, what I want is what Trump is doing, and that's what all members of his administration are doing, and that's where it's going to end up. The other tendency is worst casing, dismissive worst casing. They don't know what they're doing, or they're doing exactly what I feared all along that Donald Trump would do, like forming an alliance with Vladimir Putin, against Ukraine and against Europe.
Yeah, or what we're seeing is a return of the idea that he's Putin's puppet.
Seeing a return of that idea.
Yeah.
So I think that the truth is lies in the middle, mm-hmm. and that we should just have some humility, because lots of people seem to think they know exactly where Donald Trump is going. I don't think Donald Trump knows where he's going on many things. And, I don't think it's clear. So I think there are countervailing people in the administration, tendencies, different ways world events could ramify and cause Trump to do different things. So let's try to, as you said, quite rightly, understand what we think is going on. So a couple things that I think are going on so far.
Yeah.
Right. Number one is a more pronounced sense that the United States needs to prioritize its own hemisphere and even enlarge its realm within the hemisphere in some ways. And a kind of interest in thinking about great power relations in a potentially more cooperative or non-conflictual way than we saw in, as you said, the rather conventional first term of Donald Trump. So we might call that spheres of influence thinking ? Because I'm not quite sure that that's what it is. Or as Secretary of State Rubio put it, thinking about a multipolar or multi-great power world and what the United States' place is in such a world. The other thing we're seeing is a tactical boldness on the part of Trump that is unlike what he did in the first term or really any president that I can think of, right? The imposition of massive tariffs on Canada and Mexico that were then quickly suspended because of some pretty minor concessions by both those countries, though we still, again, don't know where that story is going to end up.
And also suspended, I think, in response to sort of pushback from Wall Street, especially the sort of stock market, but which is sort of another point of where Trump is kind of sensitive on and might react to.
That's right. That's definitely one source of contingency and constraint in all this. You know, Trump's announced plan to take over Gaza, right? Again, does he really have an intention to take over Gaza? I don't know. It may be a tactical move to try to force others to take action. So this is something we have to think about now with Trump 2 in a way we didn't really need to think about with Trump 1. And then finally,
on the Gaza point, I just want to say something, because it's kind of interesting that Trump's envoy in the Middle East has sort of said that they're not going to force the Palestinians out of Gaza. They'll ask them to leave and they expect them to listen to this, which is like to anyone who knows the situation. So it seems like, I mean, that is as horrific as it is. And I don't want to like minimize the fact that this is like, you know, like a call for ethnic cleansing of a sort that is like, you know, deeply at odds with like basic human morality and international law. As horrific as that is, like, it doesn't seem to me to have like the backing of anything. It's more like an aspiration or like a hope rather than like anything that one can see them carrying out. And I think that's an important distinction to make.
It is. It was hard to see from the very beginning how one would actually realize this plan and what exactly Trump meant, if he had even thought about how he would get Palestinians to leave Gaza. Now, you know, I could counter you and say, is Witkoff's interpretation of Trump's plan correct? Yeah. Who knows? But unless someone is going to, in fact, drive Palestinians out, it's very hard to see how that outcome would be effectuated. And then I guess I just say that the third unique theme that I see so far from Trump is, you know, the bringing of the culture war to the bureaucracy at home, the gutting of USAID, and, you know, more of these kinds of moves that we may see. I don't actually think, though, that the Pentagon cuts of 8%, those are not quite cuts. I think there was some confusing reporting around that. My understanding at this point is that what the Secretary of Defense asked for was for various parts of the Defense Department to lay out how they would cut 8% if they had to, but that is not the same as an intention to cut the overall Defense Department budget by 8%. It's an efficiency exercise meant to understand how could we make cutbacks in one place without necessarily assuming we'll make cutbacks overall. And of course, Congress, in fact, sets the defense budget.
And again, it sort of has this element of sort of like an aspirational, you know, agenda setting move rather than something that can actually be executed. But again, I think it is actually notable to have a Republican president, you know, talk about, you know, Pentagon budget cuts. What you've outlined, it does mark a shift from, you know, traditional American foreign policy of both Democrats and Republicans for a long time. I think I've argued in the past, like, there's elements of this which one can see as part of a older Republican tradition. You know, like Trump likes to cite McKinley, but like in, you know, cite the early 20th century sort of Republican realist tradition of like Herbert Hoover or Robert Taft, people who basically wanted sort of hemispheric domination, perhaps with an eye towards Asia, but disengagement from European great power politics. I don't think we have to necessarily go into the genealogy of all this, but it's not totally without precedent, like in American history, to think along these lines.
I think you're right. It's hard to find like a singular precedent for Trump, but it's usually hard to find one for any president's foreign policy. This was particularly difficult, I will admit. I will say, though, I think, you know, it seems like there's a kind of desire on the part of the administration to move toward, as you said, a Western Hemisphere plus Indo-Pacific focus for U.S. security and defense policy. That said, you know, we should not jump to conclusions about where the U.S. role in Europe will end up either.
Yeah,
I actually think, you know, it's worth reading the full speech of Secretary Hegseth when he went to Europe recently and caused all this controversy by mainly because he said that it would be unrealistic for Ukraine to get all its territory back, a loss to Russia since 2014, and unrealistic to see Ukraine join NATO as a part of a potential peace settlement. He said later in that speech that he wanted to see Europe shift the defense burden onto itself and become the leader of European defense. Mm-hmm. That's actually quite a significant statement and got lost in the Ukraine-related controversy and then later Vice President Vance's speech. And I think that, you know, remains the sort of outer boundaries of what I expect to realistically happen over the course of 4 years of a Trump administration. The idea that the United States is going to form a partnership with Vladimir Putin's Russia and completely abandon Europe and, you know, allow Russia to invade the Baltic states, et cetera. You know, I think even if Trump had that intention, it would become extremely politically difficult and costly for him to try to realize that intention. But I don't think it's by any stretch clear that he has that intention. And I'll go further. I don't think he has that intention, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're likely to see in terms of some of the more extreme outcomes would be, you know, it's possible the United States will stop aiding Ukraine, possibly this year or next year, whether as a result of a peace settlement or not. That is possible. And it's possible we'll see some conventional reductions in the U.S. military presence in Europe, particularly Eastern Europe. And those are the kinds of outcomes I would look for.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's on that point, there's two things to underscore, which is there's an element of this, which is is actually quite conventional. Like, I think there has been a desire on the part of both Democratic and Republican administrations for the Europeans to take over more of their own defense for a long time. Whether Trump's way of getting to that outcome is like ideal, you know, like one could sort of question, but
yeah,
you know, like that's not totally like off the wall, and nor is it totally undesirable. I think there's like reasons why, not just for the point of view of the United States. I actually think I've long thought that from the point of view of the Europeans, taking over their own defense would make them much more secure. It would take care of some of the moral hazard problems of making commitments that they can't necessarily back up and that the U.S., you know, might waver on. So, you know, like it's not totally undesirable. I think where one might question it, at least, you know, for me, the most troubling aspect of this Ukraine business is the overt use of NATO as an extortion racket and the use of American foreign policy to, like, you know, I mean, they want to sign some sort of crazy deal where they get like half of Ukraine's minerals or whatever. It seems like a fantasy, you know, let's dig out all the gold in Ukraine and put it in Fort Knox, you know, like, but I mean, that is very troubling You know, even though one can always argue, you know, and certainly people on the left like Noam Chomsky have long argued that a lot of American alliance systems are protection rackets, you know, where we get them to buy American weapons for American protection. But still, the how overt it is by Trump, to me, like, it's very troubling.
Yeah, the what makes Trump stand out in this regard is that he regards the typical U.S. alliance and security relationships as actually extortionary of the United States, yeah. Right? Whereas your Noam Chomsky would say it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. And so then he's looking for more. How do I get more to, like, even the scales?
Yeah, no, he thinks that American allies, including Canada, are ripping off the United States and are
right. taking advantage of it. But yeah. Here's where I think actually, though, there's something to take seriously in all of this. It's not the lust for minerals in Ukraine. And by the way, is that symbolism? Is that, like, real material imperialism? I don't know, because, like, they're not very accessible.
Yeah. So,
but it's not that, and it's not trying to seize Greenland. It's the idea that actually Hegseth put forward, citing Eisenhower when he was in Europe, saying, you know, if the United States is the primary protector of Europe for years to come, then the Europeans are making an Uncle Sucker out of Uncle Sam, something like that.
Yeah.
Right. And I actually think at this point, you are right. It's not in Europe's own interest to be dependent on the United States for the basic defense of the European continent. So if that can become, you know, the main shift that comes out of all this activity, that we start a transition, we can't end it in 4 years, because that would leave Europe vulnerable because of all the things that Europe needs to do to be able to prepare. But if we could start a serious transition, you know, I would count that as a win. And I think people on the left and Democrats ought to be trying to push for that as a realistic and indeed mutually beneficial outcome that that Trump could be pushed into.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, like, just the fact that the United States has twice elected Trump really underscores why it would make sense for the Europeans, and I would actually argue, you know, other countries in Asia, to take more control of their foreign policy. Because a country that is willing to, like, you know, elect someone as unstable as Trump, who's, you know, willing to break prior agreements, who, like, you know, the standard American foreign policy has actually had a lot of continuity from administration to administration on long bipartisan lines, and that is, like, one reason why, you know, you can sort of have some security in American alliances. Well, I feel like that's over. You know, you cannot expect the United States to be like that in the future. And at best, you're going to get swings, you know, like every 4 to 8 years from, you know, liberal internationalism to America first. And to my mind, like, if you're just looking at it from the point of view of the world, then a lot of countries should think, like, you know, this is not a reliable ally. We have to, like, hedge our bets. We have to, like, you know, have other sources of security.
And it's not just Trump that should force this recalculation, or the fact that Trump is now a two-term U.S. president. There's also a secular trend of, as we talked about earlier, the world becoming more competitive, more like a multipolar world. We were going to have this kind of a reckoning at some point, inevitably, Trump or no Trump. Mm-hmm. So, with respect to Europe, you know, the United States, Europeans think that the United States has underwritten Europe's security for 80 years. And so it's very scary to think that that might no longer be the case. Now, they have a point when it comes to the Cold War period. But in the post-Cold War period, the United States wasn't really defending Europe. Mm-hmm. Against what? There was not much of a threat. And so when the United States championed the enlargement of NATO, which on paper vastly extended the U.S. security commitment to new countries in Central Eastern Europe, it did so thinking that not that it was really serious about coming to the defense of these countries, but that by extending the NATO security blanket, this question would never arise. And so the United States has, in fact, as a country, not been serious about honoring its Article 5 commitments for decades. So it's not just Donald Trump. And if you think it's obvious what Joe Biden or Barack Obama would have done in the event of a Russian attack on NATO territory, on the Eastern Front of NATO, that they would have just gone in for a full-scale war to liberate every inch of NATO territory, I don't think it's obvious, and the Europeans shouldn't either.
No, exactly. And I would actually add, and this is not just with the benefit of hindsight, this is something that was very sober people in the 1990s were saying, that expansion of NATO not only did not offer war security, it became a source of insecurity. That this actually became a source of conflict with Russia, and it foreclosed a different pathway of perhaps like a more neutral Europe that was a bridge between East and West. I want to underscore that I've been hostile to Trump, for the last decade. But I think that the problems that we're seeing, as you indicated, are structural and go beyond Trump. And in some ways were inevitable. I think Ukraine really underscores this. Horrible as what Trump is doing. And it does seem like there's a wish to throw Ukraine under the bus and to extract some sort of protection racket from it. If Joe Biden had been more forceful in pushing for negotiations, in 2022, when Ukraine had much better leverage than it does now, it would be much better for everyone, but especially much better for Ukraine and for the Europeans. I think the larger point that you and I agree on is we shouldn't just blame everything on Trump, and that in some ways, these contradictory policies are a response to larger problems that other administrations haven't dealt with or have contributed to.
I think that's exactly right. And that's going through my head constantly as we address, one issue after another. We could apply that same point to the Middle East as well. And, just as Joe Biden was saddled with an ugly withdrawal from Afghanistan, when in fact, there was no good, clean way to lose a 20-year war to the Taliban, right? We shouldn't blame Trump for the hand that he now has to play. That said, we need to look at what he does see if it can be pushed toward the side of prudent and overdue course correction. Mm-hmm. And if it demonstrably goes into some other direction, like completely selling out Ukraine, right, becoming friends with Vladimir Putin's Russia, etc., then obviously we're in a dangerous territory, right? And we should oppose that. But a lot of people in the media, people who have worked in policy before, etc., are rushing to say that we've seen the appeasement of Russia already, just because talks have opened. In fact, negotiations for a ceasefire have not begun. There's been a meeting to set them up.
Yeah. So, talks are, in fact, just long overdue. I mean, the war is unsustainable. I mean, one sees this in the sort of recruitment crisis that Ukraine is suffering from. This is not a country that can, afford to bleed much more. But in any case, I mean, in terms of thinking through these dilemmas, for me, another sort of issue is, and this is something maybe we can end on, a figure like Elbridge Colby, who's been nominated and is, I guess, receiving some opposition from Senator Tom Cotton and others, because Colby has said, he's open for negotiations with Iran. And, to my mind, this is a good reason to, welcome Colby and support him. But I also know from Colby's own writing, my sense is, he wants to negotiate with Iran and possibly with Russia so that the United States has a freer hand for a great power confrontation with China, which is not something I don't support at all. And so for me, it's a real dilemma. How does one regard a figure like Colby, who does seem like someone that we should be able to work with, at least on some issues, but whose larger foreign policy vision I think is extremely dangerous.
I hear you. I mean, one way to think about this would be to compare Colby to what we might call a normal or replacement level Republican pick. Note that Marco Rubio, who was at least perceived as a conventional figure, whether he is now or not, was unanimously endorsed by the Senate to be Secretary of State. So Colby will be more controversial, but you know, what I see in Colby is somebody who is concerned about the limits of American power and the limits of our resources to make good on all the many defense commitments that the United States has on paper, who therefore wants to see the kind of, I think, the kind of security transition in Europe that we talked about, who is weary of getting into a conflict, a large conflict in the Middle East, and maybe among those that are relatively favorable toward a nuclear agreement with Iran, which would be a good thing, and wants to pivot to Asia. And, you know, I think you sort of got two out of the three regions seemed like an upgrade. Mm-hmm. One of them, there's a question mark, but we should look closely at exactly what his views are on China and security in Asia as well, because I think of late, he sounded more cautious notes about Taiwan, emphasized sort of frustration at the pace of Taiwan's own defense improvements. And of course, he's going to be existing in an administration with different voices on this issue, right? In the National Security Council, in the State Department, in the Vice President's office, and in his own Defense Department. So I think if you look holistically at the crop of people who are in this administration, you know, I think his voice would be quite a welcome one on a range of issues, but you know, we'll have to see how the Senate goes with this. But I do find it very curious that it seems like he will prove to be one of the more controversial Trump foreign policy picks when he's one of the few figures in foreign policy who has a real following, a real constituency among especially young conservatives. So I'm not sure that people who are trying to defend in the Senate, you know, the traditional view of foreign policy have chosen the right target here.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting battle. And I think it's one that mainstream press and the left should be paying more attention to, because it does really open up, you know, some real important questions as to the future. And I mean, I'll just say, like, you know, like the conventional Republican, you know, like, say, Lindsey Graham, wanted to fight everybody, wanted to fight, you know, Russia, wanted to fight Iran, wanted to fight China. So if you have someone who just wants to fight China and not Russia and Iran, that's like, you know, like that's at least a little bit more prudent, if nothing else. But in any case, there's going to be a lot of dilemmas. And I think that the important point, and I hope this came through in our conversation, that listeners picked up on this, is that, you know, there's actual real serious foreign policy discussions going on here. And it's not as black and white as sort of the partisan press might make it out to be. And that there are actual points of engagement that people, both liberals and I think more especially people further on the left, have to take up on all these issues. So I want to thank Stephen once again for having this conversation, which I thought was very rich.
Oh, me too. Thank you. Appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.